Welcome to PharmaTalk Radio. I'm Valerie Bowling, Executive Director. I'm pleased to bring you a series of sessions from the DPharm 2017 conference, which covers new ways of thinking about how we can advance innovation in clinical trials. The 2018 DPharm conference takes place September 25th and 26th in Boston. In this fifth podcast, we bring you patient advocate Dana Lewis, who is the creator of the do-it-yourself pancreas system and founder of OpenAPS. Dana presents on how to reduce the burden of type 1 diabetes through a model of democratized R&D.
I am the creator of a do-it-yourself artificial pancreas system and the founder of the open source artificial pancreas system movement, which is what I'm going to be talking to you about today. But I wanted to get some context before we get started, because I realized earlier, as we talk about patients, as we talk about them in clinical trials, we often talk about them as if they've already significantly gone through their journey. Like, they've already been diagnosed and dealt with the emotional upheaval, but we have to remember that a lot of the patients that we're working with, they haven't dealt with that yet. And getting diagnosed with a chronic disease is like getting struck by lightning. It's very, very hard to deal with. And everybody's journey of processing the emotions and figuring out how to deal with this new condition or disease is very, very different. And it's important to understand that. And I say that because as a person with type 1 diabetes, you've probably heard about diabetes. You may feel like you understand it a little bit. But until you actually live with it, it's actually really hard to understand just how hard that condition is. In diabetes, we're lucky because we have treatments. We have insulin. We know what to do to take care of type 1 diabetes. But even though we have insulin, many people have trouble affording it, accessing it. And even when you do get it, not everything is hunky-dory perfect, because the insulin that we have available to us doesn't really start peeking into the body until almost an hour after we've eaten. And the food hits in 15 minutes. So that's why you often see these big spikes and drops, because people with diabetes have to plan ahead, in many cases by hours, in order to properly align insulin with what they're eating. And it's not just food that impacts our blood sugar. It's also hormones and stress and adrenaline and excitement. So when I'm up here, I've just eaten lunch, and I'm excited to talk with you all, my blood sugar is probably going to go up. But how do I balance the adrenaline spike versus the food on board? It's really, really hard for a lot of people, and that's why diabetes is so very challenging. And I like to remind people that that's why diabetes, any person with diabetes, is a DIYer, a do-it-yourselfer, because a person with diabetes makes up to 300 decisions a day that impacts their blood sugar, decisions about eating and sleeping and drinking and what they're going to do. And not all of them are major decisions, but it's a lot of little decisions that add up. And for those of you within a working immune system and a working pancreas, congratulations, it's a little bit easier for you. But a lot of those decisions that you make without even thinking about the long-term impacts of really affects us in the next minutes and hours and days even. And so that's really why diabetes is so DIY. And it would be nice if we could have some technology that would help with that. I was in the elevator last night with a gentleman in this hotel who got in the elevator and made a comment about them being newfangled elevators where you press the button on the outside, you get in, and there's no buttons. It's just going to take you to the floor that you told it, and you hope you told it the right thing. And he said something like, I'm never going to get in a self-driving car because I can barely handle the self-driving elevators. And I was laughing because I would love a self-driving car, but I would also love one for my diabetes. I would love to do less work. And that's the concept of an artificial pancreas, which is technology and devices that will automatically regulate your blood sugar levels. But we're in 2017. I want to flash back and talk to you about my life in 2014 when there wasn't an artificial pancreas commercially available. The stuff didn't exist. And I was diagnosed even further back in 2002. So at this point, I've been living with diabetes for almost 15 years. And I was very lucky because I had the ability to access technology like a continuous glucose monitor and an insulin pump. And these tools were better than not having these tools, but they're not perfect. They're not interoperable. And so with all the challenges that I've described, this is a picture of what my blood sugars would look like on an average week. And the reason I have this picture formatted this particular way is because at one point, my endocrinologist asked me to bring him a week's worth of data. Well, in 2014, the only FDA-approved software for my medical device ran on a PC, and I had a Mac. So I had no way to get my data off of my medical device, which was incredibly frustrating. So what I had to do every day at the end of the day was pull the device out of my pocket, press the button, take a picture with my iPhone, send it to my computer, copy and paste it into Excel, and then at the end of the week, I printed it out, and that's what I took to my doctor. And the crazy thing is, He was okay with it because he's so used to patients bringing in drips and drabs of data from not having patients be able to access their own medical data. It's really, really frustrating, and that means that we can't take advantage and use this data in the most optimal ways, both for real-time treatment, as well as retrospective figuring out how could we do better, what else could we do differently. And my biggest frustration was also something that I couldn't solve, or at the time I felt I couldn't solve. So I have this amazing device, this continuous glucose monitor, that tells me my blood sugar every 5 minutes. And theoretically, it has alarms on it. So if my blood sugar goes too low or too high, it'll alarm. Now, while my body is challenged in that my pancreas doesn't fully function, I have a superpower that many of you don't have, which is I am the world's greatest sleeper. So I sleep really deep and really, really long. So when my CGM would be alarming on the bedside and saying, hey, you're low, Dana, wake up, drink some juice, take care of things, I would just sleep through it because I was doing my body's number one job, which is to sleep, not to wake up and drink juice. And that was really frustrating and also really scary because when I graduated from college, I moved to Seattle and lived by myself. And I was worried about what happened if my blood sugar kept dropping and I didn't wake up and there was nobody there to help me, what would happen? And I asked the manufacturers and said, hey, this is a problem. Will you make louder alarms? Will you make different alarms? Will you do something? And the answers I got back were really frustrating. I was told it wasn't a problem for most people. That's an answer every patient loves to hear. I was told they were working on it. It would be out in a number of years. Well, you can imagine every night going to bed, being afraid for your life, being afraid of not waking up the next morning. That's not a great way to live. And I was tired of hearing the manufacturers say, no, we can't do anything, or it's coming, or just wait. And so I started to wonder, you know, what if I can't change that device that I have, but what if I could add other things to the system? If only I could get my data off in real time, I have this great idea for a system that I could build that would make louder alarms, different alarms, I could share my data with my loved ones across the country. Wouldn't it be great? If only I could get my data. Remember how I couldn't get my data? So that wasn't really a possibility until in late 2014, I spotted a tweet from a gentleman named John Kostick, who has a son with type 1 diabetes, and he had figured out a way to plug in the receiver to a computer and get the data off in real time. And I actually reached out to him and said, this sounds great. I would love to use your code. Would you be willing to share it? And he said yes, and this was my first introduction to the world of open source code, which is where people will freely share code and knowledge with other people to help solve problems. And I was able to create my louder alarm system, but I was able to do so much more than I ever thought was possible. Because first, I would pull the data off in real time and send it to my phone and make it really, really loud. But I also wanted to be able to send it to my loved ones, because if I still didn't wake up to the alarm, I needed somebody else to be alerted. But they don't need to get every single alarm that I get. Because the 7980, 7980, 7980 alarms that I would get, they don't need those. They need to know if I'm 60 and haven't responded to my alarms for 20 minutes or 30 minutes. So we built this smart system, and in order to snooze the alerts for my family, I would wake up, take care of things, and press a button that says, don't wake everybody else up, I'm fine. And because I was being a wonderfully self-trained guinea pig, and seeing the value of putting in data in real time, we were able to build an algorithm that not only reacted to what was happening in the moment, but could also look out into the future hours ahead and said, you're fine now, but you're going to be low, and you can be less low if you take action now. Or you're going to be high. After this meal, you need to do more insulin, take care of things. And so it really empowered me to go from being reactive all the time and playing catch up with my diabetes to really, really being proactive. And this was just simply an open loop system where I would input data, it would make decisions, pay attention to things for me, and alert me. And I was still the human in the loop taking action. But through the course of a year, we met other people who were also working in this open source space, and one of them had spent years figuring out how to communicate with an insulin pump. And that's how we found out that we actually had all the tools necessary to build an artificial pancreas, to build the self-driving car of diabetes. If you take that same insulin pump and CGM that I had, and you add a small computer with a radio stick to talk to the pump and a battery, you end up with a closed-loop hybrid artificial pancreas system. And I have to tell you, this thing is amazing. Remember those up and down graphs I showed you before? Now look at the graphs in the top. Those flat lines represent 12 hours of uninterrupted sleep. It's amazing. And you can see the 105 picture in the far right. You can see the blue lines up and down show how it adjusts the insulin delivery while I sleep. So if my blood sugar starts dropping, it reduces the insulin. If my blood sugar starts rising, it gives me more insulin automatically while I sleep without having to wake me up. And then I still have my smart alarm system, so if my blood sugar does start extremely dropping and the system's not able to take care of it, it's able to help me. But for the most part, I don't have to wake up anymore. And I didn't feel like I could keep this to myself, number one, because it was absolutely life-changing. But number two, we had used open source code to build our system. And so we wanted to take what we had done, the algorithm portion, and turn around and make that open source, but do it in a way that it was safe. Because this is DIY. It's not regulated by the FDA. There's no company involved. And so we had to figure out, we can't distribute this thing, but we can put our code up open source. And we not only put code up to allow people to build this for themselves, but we added documentation and a reference guide that said, here are all the issues and things that we've thought through. Here's our risk mitigation strategy. Here's what kind of the limits of the system are. Here's what it can and cannot do. And that was very, very important to us because safety is my number one priority as a patient. So it's without question going to be what we focus on when we say, hey, other people, you could do this if you want. And what's amazing to me is I thought, you know, if one or two other people end up building a system like this, it'll be worth the time and effort we put to put the code out there and to write it up and to work with everybody. But what's amazing to me is now, 2.5 years later, there's over 400 people worldwide using various types of these DIY systems. And that's incredible, but also what's really significant is this community has over 2 million hours worth of patient data that they've created out of their DIY devices. Think about how powerful that is for research and discovery. And it's not costing the healthcare system anything. This is just something that patients are doing. And we're also turning around and coming up with ways to donate this data back to research, but also doing our own research and further processes of scientific discovery, because we are the closest to the data, we are closest to the problems, and we deeply understand, here's what needs to be solved, here's what needs to come next. And the title of my presentation was Democratizing Demands, and I think it's important to talk about a couple things that have continued to change and evolve thanks to the entire community that's participated in this project. Number one is smaller hardware. The first system that I used that I had pictured was a Raspberry Pi. It was a small computer compared to what we think about computers, but it was still the size of a phone or two. Well, thanks to somebody in the UK, he figured out how to use smaller hardware. So now my pancreas is this big. You may not have even noticed it on my hip when I was standing up here, but it's tiny. And it's very, very convenient to not have to carry anything around, but just have it seamlessly integrated into my life. And speaking of seamless integration, how great would it be for you to not have to change phones or device types like iPhone to Android in order to use your healthcare devices? And that's what we have with OpenAPS, is we've built a flexible system where it doesn't matter if you have a PC or a Mac, an iPhone or an Android, you can use the system however you want it. You can build it on whatever device you want, and you can use whatever devices you want. So if I want to, I can use Siri on my iPhone and send a text to my pancreas and tell it what to do. When I ate lunch and I was sitting in the room, I was able to tap a button on my watch and tell it what I was eating and allow it to dose me insulin. This is not rocket science. It's interoperability, but that's something that doesn't exist in a lot of the design and the development of medical devices. But it's absolutely important, because who wants to carry yet another device and yet another thing and have to have 8 devices to live their life? It's really not something you want to do. And the other thing that we have learned is that a lot of these closed-loop systems are a come-as-you-are system, where you come in with your baseline settings on your insulin pump, and a lot of people may have had help getting those settings going, but the healthcare professionals don't have a tool. They have kind of a rule of thumb, and they guess. And guess what? People's bodies change over time, but not everybody's settings change over the time. So some people will come in with 10-year-old settings that are very, very different for their body. And so we were able to create a tool that we called AutoTune, first intending it to be used inside the closed-loop system, but we realized it was very, very much needed for the rest of the diabetes community. And so it's a tool available for anybody, because it's open source, where you can input your data, and it will spec back and tell you, here's how much insulin you need to correct your blood sugar down. Here's what your carb ratio should be. Here's what your underlying insulin pump settings should be. And again, there's no commercial tool. There's no academic tool. Nobody in healthcare has thought about creating a tool for patients and for healthcare providers to do this until now. And now there's one that exists. So as I close, I really want to come back to something Bray said that I so appreciated earlier, which is, again, really thinking about patients and their motivations and why they're participating in the healthcare system and what they need and why to live their lives, because that's what it's really about. We want to give back because we want to be able to live our lives and for other people to be able to live their lives. But when you think about the design and the development of a drug or device, people who work for companies kind of have this mindset of, okay, we're going to build a car, so let's get the plan. And you've kind of got the 4 or 5 step process to build the car. And in 5 years, we'll have a car. Won't it be great for everybody to have a car? Well, we often forget, what is the original problem that we're solving for? What do patients actually need? It's not actually a car or a self-driving car. In this case, it's really about getting from point A to point B, and maybe we can think creatively and come up with other solutions for how to get from point A to point B. Car would be nice, but let's start with a skateboard, a scooter, move to a bike, a motorbike, and then a car. We can work our way up. But in the meantime, we're still getting from point A to point B faster than we would if we were walking. And that's the approach that patients want to take, and I want the rest of healthcare to start thinking about taking, which is this idea of, we are not waiting. Don't wait for the perfect solution that's going to work for everybody, that's going to take 5 or 10 years. Think how many patients are going to die or their lives be full of misery or less optimal than they would be if we get solutions out now as soon as possible, with a beta version in 6 months, with a beta version in a year instead of 5 years. What could we do if we decide that we're not waiting? So I'll stop there and wait for questions, but that's my challenge for you. Thank you. Any questions? If not, I'll pass on to the next speaker. Thank you.
How, okay, seriously, nobody has a question? She created an artificial pancreas. I don't know. What is your background? Like, what did you were, yeah.
That is a good question. So most people will think I am an engineer or programmer. I'm actually not. My degree is in public relations and political science with a minor in the computer-based honors program. But what's interesting about all of this is technology has evolved where patients who aren't engineers and programmers can buy this kind of computing technology on Amazon and build these things together and work with people who do have that kind of engineering background. But who here has heard of the thing called Stack Overflow? Yeah, a lot of people. So most programmers use Stack Overflow all the time. You Google and you get the coding answer from other people. Even real engineers and programmers do that. And so we patients are no different, but we have a deep understanding of how we need to design a solution, and then we get the expertise as needed on the different pieces of the technical pieces of the puzzle.
Dana, that's an absolutely amazing story, and it proves that patients nowadays are not any more patient. And this has been the expectation. I'm a physician by training, the expectation of the medical community forever. So when I was trained, the patient did what they were told to do, and if they have, we told them to be patient, because we couldn't get our acts together in medicine, they still were patient. So I hope that there are many more of yours, and that patients are taking controls of their life, because that is going to move politics, that is going to move the regulators to recognize that there is a need that needs to be answered. It is absolutely ridiculous what you said. It takes 5 years to develop something like that in today's world, where some product cycles are measured in months. So keep on spreading that message among your fellow patients who have similar issues, and I think the society and government and regulators will take notice and ease the way for these type of initiatives. Thank you.
And thank you for those of you who are already actively working with patients. And I encourage you to think more about how you can involve patients, because we really get to ask the questions of, why are we doing things this way? Does it really need to take this long? Do we really need to go this approach? And I feel like when you have a patient, somebody from the outside really asking those questions and pushing, it allows organizations to really say, yeah, we're going to do things different. We're going to speed things up. We're going to make things happen faster.
Hey, Dana, great job. Did anyone tell you, no, that's not possible? And if so, what did you do about it?
Some people told me it was impossible after I had already done it. And so that's kind of a no-brainer. But also, a lot of people have said it's not possible to continue to improve. It's not possible for people to do this themselves without an engineering background. And the community continues to prove people wrong all the time, because there's hundreds of people who have no engineering background who are doing this. We continue to develop algorithms. We kind of thought we would be done at a certain point, just because could it get any better? But literally every 2 or 3 months, we come up with a new feature that makes the system even better, even smarter. And we've been told that the algorithms that we've been developing are more advanced than anything in clinical trials or out on the commercial market, now that there is something out on the commercial market. And that's not what we set out to do. We're not setting out to compete with anybody, but we really want to set the bar high for companies and for the FDA to say, here's what's possible with very, very simple technology. What could we do when we add the expertise of the healthcare industry? But how do we add the expertise in a way that it supplements and doesn't slow things down?
Yeah, so it's very nice, and I'm sorry I missed the beginning, but have you thought about commercializing this and actually working with FDA to work on the validations? Because what happens sometimes is that when people do things themselves, they don't always understand all the significance of some of the risks that could happen. And you know, if you do it to yourself is one thing, but when it becomes more commercially, you never know. So the more you can codify this and do standard, you know, acceptable validations and get FDA buy-in to these things. So have you approached anything like this?
So we very early on decided not to go commercial. And the reason was if we decided to go commercial, we would not be able to help people. We would not be able to share our code, do anything open source. And we also knew that there are many companies out there actually working on this technology. And there's a timeline of it coming to market. The first system finally got commercially approved and is rolling out this year. There'll be three or four more by 2020, which is great. But we knew there was a long time between 2014 and even the first one coming out in 2017. And we said, you know what, if all we do is help people in the 2 or 3 years in between, that's going to be worth it for us. And we don't want to spend our time doing something commercial that may or may not succeed. So that's why we took that approach. We do actually have a great relationship with the FDA. We've had many interesting conversations with them. Starting back to the early days when my smart alarm system was first created and we first started talking about it, the FDA actually came up to us at a conference and said, you know, I wouldn't share that code if I were you because that's making recommendations and that would be a class 3 medical device. You shouldn't do that. We're like, oh, whoa, no, okay, we won't. But by the time we got to OpenAPS, we realized that even though we are putting out instructions and code and everything, that in of itself is not a medical device. And so we are able to exercise our freedom of speech to share that information online because code sitting on the internet is not a medical device. And if people choose to make it themselves, patients have the right to self-experiment. So that's why we went the route that we did. But in terms of validation and safety, that's one of the reasons why we have a reference design that describes kind of the principles of safety we use for our project so that anything we do, we're relying on existing already FDA-approved insulin pumps and CGMs. We're not actually modifying the devices that like create the data or insert drugs into our body. We are just automating the math and the communication between the devices. But safety is really, really important to us, and that's why as we encourage other patient communities to do this, that they also start with kind of this reference design of safety and their principles and kind of commit to doing the safest thing possible, because that's really what the FDA's goal is, as well as what our goal is as patients, is to be safe.
Yeah. And just one last thing. When you do this, do you design any kind of risk mitigation strategies in the event of a failure somewhere in this communication?
Oh, yeah. So we actually design the whole system knowing it's going to fail all the time. So every command that it sends, we assume that it's going to be the last one. So based on the available data, it's the most conservative thing it can do, knowing that it's going to fail at some point. It fails that many times. But also, we only issue commands that are called temporary basal rates, which means it's a 30-minute command to the pump. So at the end of the 30 minutes, if there has not been another communication from the system, it falls back to your normal insulin pump. So you're no less off than somebody running around with a normal insulin pump would be. So that was like a very important part of how we designed it to be temporary basal rate focused for that safety purpose.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
Hi, Dana. I'm Joris van Dam from Novartis. I think you were invited to the White House last year, so I was hoping to see a selfie of yourselves with our former president, but if you have one. My question is the following. So you've tremendously outpaced the industry in terms of rate of innovation. We were in a workshop yesterday where we talked about innovation and we talked about legal and regulatory challenges. And as an industry, we seem to be really good at inventing reasons why things could not be possible. And you've met those people, right? Because they tell you it's not possible what you've already done. How do you see those two worlds work together? How have they been working together, or how should they ideally work together? So you have an open source, democratized innovation model where the innovation you've done in this area is tremendous. It's trend setting. I personally think that you've accelerated FDA approvals because you cannot keep not approving something that's not on the market. So I'm not sure if the first one would have been approved last fall, if not for your work. How's the interaction going? So are the device manufacturers just copying software and then marketing your version from 3 years ago, right? Because it takes longer. And what's an ideal world where the wherewithal, the resources that larger commercial organizations have could perhaps also be used to accelerate. How do you get from 400 to 40,000 patients? Do you have thoughts on that? I'd be really curious to see how those two worlds could work together rather than...
Yeah, there's two approaches I'm taking to really help scale that. Number one is in terms of the data and the research. So I actually created what's called the OpenAPS Data Commons on a platform called Open Humans to allow people to donate their data and make it available for research. Because research is one of the things where I think there's a lot of barriers too, is not just the distribution, but the research. I was getting last fall one email a week from a researcher saying, hey, Dana, will you give me your personal data? Because it's too hard for me to get IRB approval, or it's too costly to do a study, blah, blah, blah. And I was tired of hearing their excuses, so I created a solution for them. But that also empowers us as patient researchers to be able to do research too and say, you're researching the wrong things or you're being too slow, we're gonna do it for you faster. So that's certainly one way that I expect the DIY and the open source community to help expedite things. What's also interesting to remember is when we talk about open source, it's not just open source for patients to use, it's also open source for companies to use. And what we're starting to see in diabetes is there's a lot of companies who are like, we're not gonna touch your stuff because risk and fear and uncertainty and doubt, but there are some companies who are actively looking at our code and running simulations of their code compared to ours, and I have a feeling those companies are going to be able to come to market faster and with better products, and patients are ultimately going to choose those products because they've been benchmark tested against what's available in open source. So I think it might take another year or two, but that's what I'm hoping to see more of, which is these companies coming and working with the code and tapping into the knowledge coming from the open source community, because even for the companies that say, we're not going to touch your code and we're just going to bring our product to market as it is, there's so much we learned out of 2 million hours. I've been looping for like 1,007 days. That's a lot of time. I've learned a lot of stuff. And the companies who stick their heads in the sands are basically just dooming their company because they're not going to be relevant in a couple years when there's multiple choices. And so what I'm trying to do is encourage these companies to figure out how to work with patients from this community, and not just me, but more in the community worldwide, people of all ages and sizes and, you know, socioeconomic backgrounds and stuff, to really figure out how is this technology working well or not, where the limitations and barriers, because these are free focus groups and free studies and free researchers, research studies that are being done, and it's stupid to waste it. And so I think really it's just companies kind of adopting the mindset of, just because it wasn't invented in our backyard, in our little walled garden, doesn't mean that we can't use this to come up with a better commercial technology. And that's what we're hoping to see from the open source community. But it's going to take people like y'all, people in the companies, to partner with us more and work with us more, because even that piece, it's starting, but it's not happening fast enough. And that needs to happen more. And that's how I really think it's really going to start to scale to the 10x effect. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, everybody.
Mark your calendars for the 8th Annual DPharm Conference, which takes place September 25th, 26th, 2018 in Boston. For more information on DPharm and DPharm podcasts, visit theconferenceforum.org. Thank you.